Session number 11208.
Major Eric Hooper, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Hooper?
I was born in Sandyford, and it was May 12th, 1911.
And what was your father's profession or?
Well, he was, in those days, it was called automobile engineer. That is when motor cars were starting to be popular. He was in his own business. And then,
Were you comfortably off?
oh yes, I mean, we didn't want for a great deal, you know. We didn't get a lot of luxuries, but we were reasonably well off. I mean, in those days, a lot of people were poorly clad and what have you, but we were all right.
Now, your father had some military connections, didn't he?
Well, he was in the Durham Light Infantry in the Boer War. He actually ran away from home when he was about 18 years old, and the only thing my grandmother knew about it was when they received a notification that he was on board ship on the way to the South Africa.
Had he stayed in the army after the war?
Oh no, he came out at the end of the campaign, and it was only a short time sort of service.
What about the First World War? Did he re-enlist?
Well, he tried to volunteer, but unfortunately, owing to his driving during the darkness with cars as they were in those days with no bright lights and what have you, it affected his eyes, and he wasn't accepted. But he later on, owing to his engineering ability, he was drafted into the aerodrome, which was on the Newcastle Town Moor. And he was put in charge of a department which was called the I don't know the name of the department, but it was the department where they got bits of German aircraft, etc., and examined it and what have you.
What, from the Zeppelins and
From
stuff?
Zeppelins, yes. Yeah.
And did the war affect your childhood at all? You'd be
No,
fruit.
no, no. No, because I mean, excuse me, mere fact that he was in the Newcastle Town Moor, which was only a matter of what, a mile from where we lived. You know, he just came back home for his lunch or his dinner. And he did have to do a night shift on occasions.
What about after the war? I believe he changed profession.
Well, after the war, as a matter of fact. Instead of going back to his old business of motor engineering, he took up bookmaking because during the war when he was at the aerodrome, a mere fact that he used to come home for his dinner at midday-ish, a lot of the employers there used to ask him to take bets to a local bookmaker, which he did. And after a while, my father realized that he was taking less money back than he was given to the bookmaker, and he thought it was a good idea. Therefore, he decided he would keep the bets himself, and realized it was profitable. So he went into bookmaking after the war, and he had an office in Newcastle, which was they used to be called in those days commission agents.
And he did well out of that.
Well, he did reasonably well. I mean, we were lucky to have motor cars when other people hadn't.
Now, how many were there in the family?
The mother and father, and I had two other brothers, so there was three boys and mother and father.
What was your first school?
My first school was Sandyford Road Council School, which I was there until I was 10 years old.
And what type of education were you getting there?
Where was the usual education, which was the 3 R's.
And where did you go from the council
From
schools?
there I went to Dunmallan School, which was in Newcastle upon Tyne. It was then situated in Northumberland Road, next to the drill hall of the 6th Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. Afterwards, the school was rebuilt up in the west end of Newcastle, which was quite a big school now.
And that was a private school, wasn't it?
A private school, yes.
What sort of education? Was that a grammar school style?
Yes, well, we had, you know, we had the Latin and French, which you didn't have in the ordinary schools in those days, and science and chemistry. And as a matter of fact, the school was more or less a Church of England school, because the governors were from the Newcastle Cathedral, and the choir boys of the Newcastle Cathedral, they were educated there. And I was actually brought up as a Methodist, so instead of taking catechism, which was once a week, I used to have to take extra maths.
Were you particularly academic or sporting? Or?
Well, I was 50-50. I wouldn't say I was a brilliant sort of boy. I mean, I enjoyed a bit of sport rather than learning.
And now, was there an officer's training corps?
Yes, there was the officer's, what was called Dear Mallon's OTC Cadet Force. And we were affiliated to the 6th Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. And our headmaster, who was the colonel, he was known as Colonel Brewer because he was attached to the 6th RNF in the Territorial Army. And he was our commanding officer.
When did you join? Were you encouraged to join the OTC?
Oh, yes.
Did everyone join it?
Oh, no. No, a lot of parents didn't believe in the army in those days, because it was shortly after the First World War.
How did your parents feel?
Oh, they didn't mind. Yeah.
And how old were you about when you first joined there?
I reckon about between 13 and 14.
And what were the what did the OTC do at the school? What were the activities?
Well, we had a band, which I wasn't a member, and they were lucky because they used to have morning sessions off for band sessions. Yeah. But as far as I was concerned, we used to drill in the drill hall, you know, the ordinary arms drill and foot slogging and what have you. A little bit of what you would say, lectures.
What about?
Well, about defence and attack and...
Tactics.
Tactics in general, you know, yes. And then we used to go to Ponteland, where they had a rifle range and a camp, which they still have now, to this very day, still there now. We used to go there doing shooting and... doing a certain field exercises, again, a sort of tactics, field tactics.
How many were there in the OTC?
Oh, I reckon there'd be about 35.
And was Colonel Brewer the only instructor? Was he instructed you?
We had an RSM who was the caretaker of the school. He was also in the Territorial Army attached to the 6th RNF.
And he trained you?
He trained us.
How often a week would you get this drill?
We got the drill about twice a week, which was after directly after school hours.
How... did you have a uniform?
Yes, we were dressed up as the soldiers were in those days, with the ordinary service dress and putties and ammunition boots. And we also trained with the... the 303 Lee Enfield rifle, and the bayonets of those days, the long bayonet.
Any other weapons?
No other weapons. No.
Did you get any promotion in the OTC for any years in it?
No promotion.
What about camps? Were there any?
Well, we had camps at Ponteland.
That's the only place.
The only camps we had.
How often would you go there?
When you went there, 1 week camp, which was the race week. Which was in the last week in June, and then we'd have the odd short weekend camp, Saturday morning until sort of Sunday afternoon.
Would other OTCs send their people there at the same time? Or
not when we were there, no.
So you were in the OTC. What age were you when you left school?
I was 16 when I left.
So that'd be 1927.
Yes.
And did you have any career in mind when you left?
I rather fancy going into the antique business. And so I applied to a firm in Newcastle which was called Sopwith and Company, which was a family firm, and they made their own furniture, and it was what it was called an exclusive furnishing firm. And
what were you going in as?
Well, I just went in there, and I went through with the three departments, which was the soft furnishing department, which I did somewhere about 1.5 years in there. Then I went into the carpet department, and then from then into what was called the cabinet department, which was the furniture department.
Did you stay with Sopwith until the war?
No, I left Sopwith, and then I went to Robson's, which was also an exclusive furnishing firm in Newcastle. And then I was with them until the outbreak of war. And then after the war, I went back to them again for a short time.
Now, just a point. Had you been in, besides the OTC, had you been in any other boys' organisations of the sort of the Boys' Brigade, Church
I did have a short period in the Boy Scouts.
What Boy Scouts activities
in the,
did you
Well, yeah, I was in the 4th Newcastle Troop of the Scouts, and that was stationed at Jesmond Parish Church. And I used to go there on a Friday evening doing the ordinary Scout training.
What kind of thing was it with that group?
Was it was teaching you sort of field craft and the usual scouting business, you know, of tracking and what have you. Used to go for weekends, and they used to put the ordinary trail out, where a bit of a paper trail, and they'd put the ordinary sticks where they used to put the arrow in that direction, and then there'd be an arrow with a box with three in it, and there was a letter, you know, hit somewhere 3 feet from this, or 3 yards from this particular arrow, you know, that sort of thing.
How military were they, orientated with
the
activities?
Oh, not military, no, it was opposite of the military. It was I suppose when you do mention that, there was a certain amount of military in it, because, again, the tracking, you know, for scouting, where, you know, they taught you to follow trails and... You know, if anybody
was there much
to,
drill?
Well, there was drill, and that was the, you know, every Friday night, the first thing we did was to have a bit of drill for smartness, you know, for marching and what have you, the left turn. In those days, of course, we did form fours. You know, you formed up in two ranks, and then you got the word of form fours, and you sort of took one pace to the rear and then one pace to the right, you know, that sort of thing.
So it was sort of half and half.
Half and half.
Mm-hmm. And that was the only boys' other boys' organisation.
Oh yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Now, when did you first become involved with the Territorial Army? Then,
well, I joined the Territorial Army. It would be, and now I'm not quite sure. I think it was actually about the beginning of 1938, because. I was looking up a photograph the other day, and I noticed it was taken at Merton when we had a camp there in the back end of 38. So it must have been in the beginning of 38.
How did you come to join? What interested you in the Territorials?
Well, it was formed from a club of which the colonel of the 5th RNF was a member, and also the honorary colonel of the 5th RNF was a member. And it got to the time when, you know, we thought that more or less war was imminent, and they thought it would be a good idea if we formed what was called a black-coated company.
What club was this? It does help if we...
Well, it was the Masonic Club in West Avenue.
And you were a member as well at that time?
I was a member, yes.
And you hadn't thought of joining the Territorial before then?
Oh, no.
After your OTC?
No.
Why
no.
was that? Did it just not appeal?
Well, no, I mean, as I was a young lad then, you know, and that sort of thing wasn't in my mind at the time.
Now, the colonels, they suggested forming a black-coated company. Could you explain exactly what that was?
Well, it was a company where it, in other words, it was a commercial company, if you like, or a company of different branches of businesses, such as we had a member who was whose father, and he also was employed by a jeweller's in Newcastle. We had bank managers and people of and big business managers.
Were they all Masons, or was it just
no,
the Masonic
no, no.
Thing
Some,
that started?
One of them, two of them were, but not the majority of them were not Masons. No, no.
So the impulse came from the Masonic side.
Yes, it started. Yes, aye.
And how did they go about forming it, and what part did you play?
Well, what happened was we'd have what was called in the Northeast pot pie suppers, where we went to a certain pub where they had a room which you could hire for social occasions, and they would put on perhaps a pot pie supper, which down the south is known as steak and kidney puddings. Okay? A little bit of entertainment, and of course there's plenty of beer, and we would discuss certain things, and then we would bring some of our friends along, and they were induced to join, and eventually we formed the company, which was the 410 company of the 5th R&F, and we selected our own officers and our own NCOs.
How did you... At what stage were the Northumberland Fusiliers involved? Right from the start, or did you sort of go to them with the company almost?
No. What happened was that the 5th R&F had two companies at the time. It was 409 Company and 410 Company. And they then formed the company which was 408 Company of the 5th R&F.
And these companies were... They weren't normal companies, A, B, and C. What exactly were they?
Well, what happened was the company was made up of so many detachments, and the detachment consisted of two NCOs, which was the sergeant, who was the detachment commander, and you had the second in command, who was the lance corporal, and then you had the other ranks, which. I can't exactly remember what their jobs were now, but I know number five was in charge of what was called the long arm of the searchlight.
It was a searchlight company.
No, it was a searchlight company, yes. Yes.
Do you remember what any of the others did? What was the long arm?
Well, the long arm was actually the arm which extended from the lamp, and it had a wheel which, number five, he turned that wheel round to give... deflection or inflection or what have you see, and he was given instructions. See, he wore headphones. He was given instructions by the number six on the sound locator, which I was the number six. So I was also in command of a Lewis gun, which was there for any attack from low flying aircraft, and with a sound locator, I had to either give him directions whether to left, right, raise, or depress. See?
How did you work the sound locator?
Well, the sound locator in those days was the old-fashioned type with the four horns, which were like on a parallelogram. What's the word again?
Similar.
I guess you've got the word anyway. Right. And what happened was you had headphones, and if there was an aircraft in the air, you turned these sound locators to get a tune or a noise where it came across your forehead. And when you got their forehead, you're more or less on target. And you had a ring which you looked through, and that give you a direction where the aircraft should be, and you directed the beam onto that particular part of the way where the sound was.
And was this an easy skill to get? Or?
Well, to be quite honest, I don't think it was very, very successful. Later on, they got the automatic sound locators, the great big things, you see. But I suppose it was all right for training.
Now, we've gone a bit onto training, but First, how did you go about selecting your NCOs?
Well, we selected, first of all, our detachment of 10 men. And then we got together and then we discussed it. Well, who do you think is the most suitable for detachment commanders? And we had a sort of more or less a show of hands, you know.
And you became a Lance Corporal?
A Lance Corporal.
Was that right from the start?
Right from the start.
And before you got onto the actual training in the searchlight and such, how did you have to go through a course in your basic training again?
No. We did nothing like that at all.
So
We more or less had instruction on the lamp, and also had instruction on the Lewis gun. You know how it should be fired, and all the various faults which could occur. And in other words, we had instruction more or less similar to the Bren gun, how to take it apart and how to reassemble it again. And then we had sort of competitions who could do it the quickest. You know.
Did you get to practice firing?
We never actually fired it. Never fired it.
And as number six, mm-hmm. You said you were in charge of the Lewis gun as well?
Yes.
Would that mean in action you'd be in charge of firing it?
Oh yes, I'd be in charge of firing, because it was erected just beside where I was.
So you could do the sound locating and the firing?
And the fire. Well, the point was that the sound locating would have been up the creek, I mean, as far as that's concerned, that the first thing would be getting the low-flying aircraft if everyone turned up.
How often would you go to where did you have to go? Where was your drill hall?
At West Avenue, which is actually next to the Masonic Club.
And how often would you report there for training or duty?
Well, we reported about twice a week.
And what would you do on a typical night?
A typical night would be just be lectures, because I'll be quite honest. In that particular time, everybody were more or less, they didn't know anything about searchlights. They'd just been turned into a searchlight unit from an infantry unit. So everybody...
The whole of the battalion was searchlights then?
Yeah, the whole of the battalion, yes, were searchlights then. And what used to happen was that the officers they were sent to were in courses. And they came back and sort of told us what they'd more or less learned, just instructed us. And again, you know, we didn't have a great deal of training, because by then the Munich crisis was on, and we were put into what was called then couverture, which we were called up for a month. And we were sent to camp, and then from there we were sent to various what they call what happened was each detachment was given a particular area where they would in time of war they would be sent, and you erected your equipment, and you were there. Your war station, you were in your war station.
And where had you actually been during your coverture? Where was the first part, the camp part?
The first
this
camp...
This is in 38.
Yes, the first camp we went to was Merton. And I may say here, prior to going to Merton, we had to go to a big depot in the Gosforth area, which was actually, in fact, I didn't know it existed, it was underground. And from then we were given all the... equipment necessary to bring it up to war standing.
What equipment had you previously had? You weren't fully equipped.
All we had then was just the searchlight and the Lewis gun.
Did you have a full complement of searchlights and Lewis guns?
Yes, we had the full complement. What we had to go down there was get ammunition. Get cooking utensils, getting tentage, and we had to get to what was a couple of chairs, which were called spotting chairs, which were for the spotters who used to have to these chairs, you could recline in these chairs, and with binoculars, you know, you could scan the skies. And they also were supplied with what they call night binoculars for seeing it at night time.
So you got this underground depot. Whereabouts in Gosforth was it?
I just can't remember the area now where it was. It was, I didn't know it existed. It was sort of it was secret. Yeah.
And by the way, how many sections were there? How many searchlights were there in the company?
There were five. Five.
So you went off, and then you went to camp on this coverture.
Oh yes, we went to camp on the coverture. Naturally, the camp was we went to our war stations. And then what happened after we were there for probably about a week? We changed war stations and went to another one that beside Seaton Sluice.
Where was your first one, by the way?
This was at Merton.
Now, did you prepare? I'll ask you when we do the real mode. Did you prepare a proper searchlight base?
No. All we did there was just to put the searchlight on the surface. And we used to have it training at night time where they would. Aircraft would be coming across, you know, for exercise, for to teach us to spot and what have you.
How successful were you at these exercises?
I would say reasonably good. It's reasonably good.
So you moved from Merton to Seaton Sluice?
Merton to Seaton Sluice, and we were there for a while.
Do you remember what month it was? Was it the month of the actual crisis, or...?
No. It was before the actual crisis, before that, before that.
Yeah. And after being at Seaton Sluice, you...
Yeah. Well, after Seaton Sluice, that's where we stopped there for the rest of our curvature.
And came back.
And just came back, and then we were just went home, you know, sort of demobbed.
When you were on these movements, how did you move the searchlights about? You presumably had some...
You had a vehicle, you had a three-tonner, and also you had a... a Lister generator, which the three-tonner used to tow. And the three-tonner used to take the searchlight plus the other ranks.
And the generator, I presume you were trained in how to use that?
Oh, yes. Fortunately, we had an hour detachment. We had a... I forgot what his number was now. Well, it was number... Each had numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 10, you see, the 10 members in a detachment. I forgot what his number was now, but he was an electrical engineer with railroads, and of course he knew all about these sort of things. And we were very, very lucky. As a matter of fact, that same bloke, he finished up the war as a brigadier.
How did you get on with the other ranks?
We were all friends. I mean, even during the... you know, ordinary walks of life. We used to have a meet up and have a few beers, you know, in some pub. You know, we were really friendly.
Were you on? You were a lance corporal, not a senior, but were you on first name terms with?
Oh yes, we're all yes, everyone.
What about the higher ranks, the officers?
Well, our officer. I mean, when we were off parade, he was Johnny, as a matter of fact. But on parade, we respected his rank.
Well, you'd have one officer with each section, would you?
No. Yes, I beg your pardon. I think a section consisted of three searchlights. That's right. And he was in command of three searchlights, but you had...
Each searchlight had 10 men.
They had 10 men, and a sergeant was a detachment commander of each... So that detachment commander was one searchlight, and the nine other ranks. Or Lance Corporal and 8 other ranks.